This is Mae Brussel, and this is the second half of tape number 853, April the 11th, 1988. This is out of the newspaper in Arkansas. A little bit more description of the trial as it came about there. I had some of their nasty stuff on these tapes before, but I think it bears sharing how they think and how these people feel, because they're all acquitted and ready to continue what they were doing. Part of the testimony of one of the persons said that whites came from a race of giants, blacks descended from the apes. Miles followed co-defendant Richard Butler on the stand after a two-day delay when David Lane was sick for a while. And Miles, who is a pastor in Michigan, a church he founded in 1970, he gave off his robe as the grand master of the Klan to become a minister, and he wanted to tell the court about his background. He said, "I always had pride in race and upbringing. My grandmother told me the family had lineage to the race of the giants. I had the mark of the giants, the marks of freckles and green eyes. In our belief, the blacks were the ape race right from the beginning. If I were a Viking sailing around a West Africa, if I was down West Africa and I was swinging in the trees with the pygmies, then they would be superior to me," he said. He calls blacks Congoids, preaching for against race mixing. But the order, he said, was a group of people that was put together, and he believed that a CIA group was out to destroy the Aryan nations. Richard Butler said he has a sign over his compound that says whites only. That's a territorial imperative. It is a biological fact that every living thing needs a territorial imperative, its own space to survive. And Richard Butler, remember, worked at Lockheed on the U-2 program and was in the defense industry until he put on the cloak of the minister under the guise of Aryan nations. The Justice Department attorney Carlson asked Butler if he thought a war would be waged in the United States. He said, "I believe there's a continual warfare, yes, sir, going on in this country against white males." And that's the gentleman I was talking about last week who works with the National Guard of Utah and the group that used live ammunition training for World War III here in the United States. Butler said, "This war goes on all the time. The enemies of the Aryan race include people in power, members of Congress who have been against them. Butler has developed through the years an admiration for Adolf Hitler. I admire him. Yes, sir, I admire him." And Miles went back into the genesis of the story of the giants of the earth, and Jews are the spawn of Satan. And, of course, I've had that on the tapes before. Miles grew up in New York during the Depression. He joined the Free French Resistance effort before fighting the Navy for the Navy in World War II, moved to Detroit, became active in the Republican Party, and after the black insurrections of the riots of 1967, he knew that religion and politics don't mix, they're inseparable, and so he went allegedly out of the Republican Party into religion and became a priest. He worked for George Wallace's campaign. He was convicted of fire bombings earlier that I had mentioned, but that's the Mr. Miles, and that was the testimony of one particular day before the case was closed. Another article, top headline is, "Contempt for Government is Apparent." This is out of the Southwest Times Record, March 31st. Robert Miles did not plot to stir up revolution in the United States, he said, but he did attempt to hide from the jury his contempt for the United States government. The government is inherently evil. It's like medicine. If you don't need it, you're better off without it. The government is corrupt, self-serving, akin to the school of sharks, cutting at each other. In Michigan, where he preaches, he referred to the government as la cesspool grande. I mean, it's a place where ideas and concepts get emptied like you do your toilets. He admitted writing once that when he took over his church, that he would joyfully demolish the buildings in Washington, D.C. "I would like to see Washington, D.C. converted to a national park. The foe of all people who believe in their race is in the American government," Miles said. "We're in a war between the spirit of darkness and the spirit of light, a psychological rather than physical struggle, and at the present time, the foe is the federal government and Satan." And he, this Nazi, refers to the government as Satan, which is interesting. "Your law is superseded many times, sir, by a moral law," he told the U.S. attorney Steve Snyder when the officer asked him about the government. "This reminds me of that blank look that Fawn Hall had when sometimes your law has to pass. You have to go above the law," Mr. Miles was saying. his law is superseded many times by a moral law. And he's giving this lecture to the prosecutor there in the case. And the prosecutor, of course, had a weak prosecution, and these people weren't being charged for their ideas. They were being charged for plans to overthrow the government and for meetings where the plans were made. And at that time, Mr. Ellison was wearing the United States Army uniform, and he came to these meetings in his uniform as a military soldier of the U.S. government. And, of course, they used the U.S. weapons arsenals, where weapons are missing from Utah and every other state, for their activities. So they use the government for some purposes. One time they bragged about sitting on a lot of money. That's when they broke that delivery truck for the Ukiah Bank and took that money out. But the case has concluded that it's over, and the judge said at one point after several weeks, then I'm going to close this in 2 days, that this 7 weeks case only should have taken 3 weeks. It's gone too long, and I think at this point everybody ought to quit calling witnesses. That was U.S. Judge Morris Arnold, who just stopped calling people and said, I've had enough of it already, let's get this over with. And it was over with, and they were all acquitted. And the judge really believed in the beginning it should take about 5 days, and several people were sick. And 1 week, the judge's father died. Elderly gentleman, but he died. So that took out from the 2 weeks. I subscribed for 3 months to the darn newspaper, thinking the trial would be going on for a long time. I don't know what I'll be reading in that newspaper for the months to come that I paid for, but we'll soon see. Now, along those lines and working with these people is Richard Butler, is a gentleman who worked his way into the establishment, always was establishment. Richard Butler of the Aryan Nations of Lockheed, as I said before, the U2 program, who worked in Burbank with Thane Caesar, the man who shot Robert Kennedy from the back of the head. This gentleman's name I've had on broadcast earlier, about a year ago. His name is William Pierce. And there's an article about him. He took over the American Nazi Party and changed the name of the organization to National Alliance. Mr. Rockwell was running the Nazi Party in Washington. Lee Harvey Oswald had his name and telephone number in his address book. Rockwell was murdered, and along came Mr. Pierce. Pierce worked for the Air Force. He had a salary from the Air Force. He taught college in Oregon. He wrote the Turner Diary on how people should, Jews should be strung coast to coast on the telephone poles with their throats cut. And when he took over the Nazi Party, he had come from working for Alexander Hague's United Technology. His salary there was $29,000 at Pratt & Whitney. And he became editor then, at the time actually he was editor of the National Socialist World. And Mr. Pierce then went to Virginia and took over the Nazi Party. And he's in the news this week, April the 1st, 1988, in the Washington Post. The title of the article is Supremacist Force, American Telephone and Telegraph, AT&T, to set a vote on hiring. Now, this may be a first. I don't know how much of this is going on, but it's very important. And the subtitle is Shareholders Have to Decide on Minority Jobs. Not the state or the Congress, but the shareholders. And this is what it says. Charleston, West Virginia. Contending that blacks are intellectually inferior, a white supremacist group has forced the American Telephone and Telegraph Company into asking the individual shareholders to vote on ending the company's minority hiring program. The management of AT&T has recommended that shareholders vote against the proposal. AT&T has had a long-term commitment to the advancement of women and minorities. However, the racist group, the National Alliance, and this is the guy from United Technology, where Alexander Hague was president of it, and keep in mind Hague's mentor, Fritz Kramer, always behind these people, the giant behind him, the racist group, National Alliance, offered the resolution for the AT&T annual shareholders when they met in Denver for April the 20th. The Security and Exchange Commission has held that it must appear on the ballot with minor changes in wording, despite the company's objections. It will appear. Look for this in the newspapers if there's anything April the 20th. And the subtitle here is Devotees of Adolf Hitler. The National Alliance is a Washington-based organization that promotes the study of Hitler's writings. Its leader, William Pierce, also heads the white supremacist Cosmotheist Church. He has become a religious leader. After teaching in Oregon and getting his money from the Air Force, a huge contract at one time he got from the Air Force, he was assistant professor of physics at Oregon State University in 1965. And worked for the Air Force, born in Atlanta, Georgia, did basic research for the Air Force of $35,000 on semiconductors, then went to Pratt & Whitney, which is United Technology. He joined the John Birch Society. He was a candidate in the Republican, he supported 1964 candidacy of Barry Goldwater as part of the election of conservative Goldwater in 64. Then went into his private Nazi group, and he now also is a priest, like Richard Butler and his friend Miles from Michigan. Miles has headquarters in the Pocahontas County, West Virginia. He is the author of The Turner Diaries, a fictional account of a race war that ends in the domination by worldwide Hitler-inspired regime. And working out of Pratt Whitney Air Force and University of Oregon, keep in mind, these people have high contacts or contacts with the Defense Department, but he wants the world domination of Adolf Hitler. And last week I was talking, or 2 weeks before, about the Aryan Nations and the rehearsal for World War III, getting the weapons and using the National Guard. The National Alliance bought 100 shares of AT&T stock in 1986, and this is the way they're moving right into these corporations. And he told the Charleston Daily Mail that the group's members had been working on AT&T campaign for a year and a half. In a statement sent to shareholders, the National Alliance asserted that AT&T's hiring of blacks sacrifices the long-term benefits of personnel quality for the short-term approval of pressure groups. And remember, Charles Lindbergh said that by losing World War II, we set back for eons of years and caused the mongrelization of the races. The article continues, the resolution says minority hiring has negative effects on the morale of people working at AT&T. Now, if the Aryan Nation starts buying stocks and corporations, be careful of what can happen as they work from this end. AT&T and management has recommended a vote against the proposal from a New Jersey shareholder that asked that the company reformulate its affirmative action programs to ensure that racial minorities and women are not under-ritualized in upper, middle, and executive levels of corporate structure. Now, that is an important article in the way that William Pierce, a gentleman I talked about a long while ago, it seems like a long while ago, I don't remember the tape number or the date that I talked about him, but I did, and now he is not silently, he's working vocally to get himself into a situation buying stock on corporations, and where is he getting his money to promote the idea of a worldwide Hitler. Now, there have been a lot of articles of Edwin Meese. I've updated some, not into great detail. I should do more, but there are two important articles on Meese that I want to share with you now. Because one of these came from the San Jose Mercury and isn't wire services, so maybe you haven't seen it. This is April the 6th, 1988. Justice Department landlord pays Meese's wife. We've heard that Ursula Meese got money from the Bender Foundation, that they're investigating her salary and her money. And now it turns out that the family owners of the buildings leased to the Justice Department are paying the salary of Ursula Meese through a special grant that they gave her. They also are in charge of the Multiple Sclerosis Society, and there was a $120,000 grant to her employer, the Multiple Sclerosis Society. The three-year grant to MS was made on behalf of the Bender family, including Howard Bender, his wife Sandra, who are social acquaintances of the Meese, and they pay her $40,000 annual salary until January of 89. The job was obtained by Robert Wallach, the longtime friend of Edwin Meese. Now, the Justice Department rents two buildings that are owned by the Bender family. They pay an annual fee of one building, $5.6 million, and another building of $1.5 million, which is $7 million goes from United States tax dollars to pay Mr. Bender rent on the Justice Department buildings, and they in turn grateful for the $7 million rent, pay Mrs. Meese's salary of $40,000. Now, it would be very interesting to know, and I haven't researched this yet. I'd like to have time to do it, or recommend some of you eager beavers do it. Maybe we can find out from the Justice Department when the lease was signed. Was it signed in 1970, 1975? How often it is renewed? Because if these two buildings, to the tune of $7 million, were paid by the federal government to the Bender family, and they in turn used part of that profit to pay Mrs. Meese, this is a tangled web that really should be open more, and it's not on the nightly evening news. And the relationship of the profit of the Benders to the payoff of the Attorney General for his same department where he is the Attorney General, wasn't in the Agriculture Department, or it would be bad enough to be another area. So the Justice Department rents for the $7 million and then pays back Mrs. Meese. So if the lease was signed any time that Ronald Reagan became president, and then she draws a piece of their profit, it would be interesting to know if there was competitive bidding in wanting to rent that building, and how high or how low the offices could be rent for. And did the Justice Department, for example, give them $7 million for the annual fee when it really was worth $3 or $4 million? How much profit did the Benders make by renting to the Justice Department? Who else could have rented the building, and what date the rentals took place? This is one of the most horrendous stories, and of course, Meese's stories keep building up. And then the Washington Post, March 30th, has an article, the independent counsel subpoenas Ursula Meese's job records. And then there was another story this week that the Justice Department is going to continue the Meese investigation and ignore the special prosecutor, Mr. McKay. So the rental of those buildings at that huge fee may be a matter that could save some tax money and could have been a wonderful way to pay her off in return for her husband giving them the lease at that price, and I don't know if it's worth it. Now, there's a lawyer in Washington. Most of you researchers know his name. His name is Bernard Fensterwald. Bernard Fensterwald Jr., I've mentioned him on different broadcasts before. He headed a group originally called Committee to Investigate Assassinations. He is a CIA attorney. He's the attorney who represented James McCord in the Watergate hearings. McCord broke open the whole case in March of 73. He's the attorney I called the day after the men were arrested at Watergate Hotel and said, you know who was caught last night? Some of the men who killed Kennedy. Fensterwald has a organization in Washington called Assassination Archives and Research Center. And I've never been a part of it. His board of directors includes some of the researchers you know by name. Robert Cutler is one of them. Fred Cook, who writes wonderful books. And Mr. Jim Hogan, who wrote Spooks, one of the great ones, is on the board of directors. Dr. Paul Hawk, who I suspected of being an agent. Carl Oglesby, I always suspect him also. I won't run down the analysis of these people. William Turner, Anthony Summers, Peter Dale Scott. There's a group of about 20 people on the board of advisors to the organization. And I decided that it was time to join the organization and share some of their videotapes they have, which become available for members who subscribe or support the organization. And I'll give you the address. It's called Assassination Archives and Research Center, Suite 510, 918 F Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20004. I'll put it on the sheet that accompanies the broadcast. I don't know why I spend time reading it to you. But anyway, I got a letter from Bud saying, Dear May, just a note to say how pleased I was to hear from you after a long, long silence. Here's a list of books that can be loaned from the library, audio and videotapes. Hope this finds you well. I remain, as always, with warm regards, Bernard Fensterwald. Now, what was a primary interest to me, or of interest, was a list of available videotapes, about 24, and they're on the movies Rush to Judgment, Two Men in Dallas, The Trial of Lee Harvey Oswald. They're movies about John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream, The Second Gun, and he has a library for people to write and obtain these tapes. There's 25 that are listed. Now, number 24 on the list is Manson. And I wondered, and I will be writing to Bud, why Manson is on this list. because I am the only researcher, I believe, in the United States of America and probably in the world who gave the Manson family murders the same importance as the Kennedy assassinations, the John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King. And those of you who've been to my home know that I have a library of articles in chronological order up till Watergate when the story broke. Then I had to put them into files. There was so much of newspaper articles on the murder of John Kennedy, then Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, Chappaquiddick, George Wallace shooting, and Manson. And I have 6 spiral notebooks, 3 hole, filled with material on Manson. And from the day that the Manson story began to unfold, it involved people like Lawrence Schuller, the writer who was with Jack Ruby up till the time he died, and Charles Manson's attorney was Joseph Ball of the Warren Commission, who came into the case. And there were many overlaps into the murder of John Kennedy that I could see immediately. So, Fensterwald has also a list of books available in the library, and among them is Bugliosi's book, Helter Skelter. So, okay, Fensterwald, now I've got to write and ask him, where did you catch on to the Manson family? This is all John Kennedy and Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. Where does Manson fit into your plan or scheme? Why is the Manson there, and how come not one of those members of the advisors, and maybe 50% of them know me, not a single one would ever say, hey, what's this thing about Manson? How does it connect? They'd say, she's off the wall to talk about Manson. There's nothing to Manson. He's just a crazy loner. And, of course, this was a huge military operation done identical to the political assassinations, as carefully planned and as carefully covered up. The National... rather, the New Federalist, the newspaper changed his name for New Solidarity, that Lyndon LaRouche gets out, has a long article, March 18th, judge orders the George Bush files search for LaRouche case, and I mentioned some of that before, how Lyndon LaRouche discovered that his name was among the papers of Oliver North and General Secord, and you know, a group in Texas was investigating him. And as this came out in the trial, I mentioned how his own defense attorneys didn't believe him, but now they have to go into the stories that Fred Lewis collected information against LaRouche, and LaRouche has been saying all along that he thought the FBI and CIA had penetrated his operations. Now, the interesting thing about this long article, and I'll do more on the article later because it's very important, is that the law office, the defense attorney for Fensterwald, for Lyndon LaRouche, is Daniel Alcorn, A-L-C-O-R-N, who is a law partner of Bernard Fensterwald. And I knew the Fensterwald office was involved with the LaRouche investigations of the Iran-Contra affair. And the Fensterwald office was also key, working with James McCord to break open the Watergate story as it gushed open. So there may be some surprises, as I mentioned before on the tape. It would be interesting if LaRouche broke open and stopped the George Bush presidency. It would be interesting if this law office and these people could do to George Bush what they did to Richard Nixon and give him his goodbye papers, because this is the term representing LaRouche and has access to the COINTEL programs, the National Security Agency, the FBI, and the judge has stopped the case against LaRouche looking into Fred Lewis. Now, I remember the name Fred Lewis and looked up my material, and sure enough, there was an article also in the Washington Post, Who Are the People Behind Lyndon LaRouche? March 27, 1988, Washington Post. 2 Texans play a role in the LaRouche case. And who do you think they are? The very 2 people I've done several broadcasts on. One is Gary Howard, and the other is Roy Tucker from the Peregrine Association in Dallas, Texas. That's the group that was hiring people to kill. That's the group that said, we have to do the dirty work that the government isn't allowed to do. This is the group that John Singlau worked with. These are the people that had direct access to the Defense Intelligence Agency, to Daniel Graham, to the high offices of George Bush and the CIA. And now LaRouche has traced those people harassing him and the shadowy government right to Peregrine in Dallas, Texas. The article says, when the federal government wanted to learn more about the shadowy, conspiracy-obsessed world of the intrigue traveled by Lyndon LaRouche, it talked to 2 people who knew his terrain, 2 Texans who for years had made the world of conspiracy and intrigue their natural habitat. Gary Howard and Ronald Tucker emerged 2 weeks ago as key figures into the federal conspiracy trial against Lyndon LaRouche. LaRouche may make millions of dollars suing the federal government for a COINTEL operation against him, which is, of course, illegal, and he may get a handle on this and move swiftly. The article says Tucker and Hauer are bolstering a central theme of Lyndon LaRouche's group in their defense that the government secretly tried to infiltrate the group at the same time the officials assembled their criminal case against the man who wants to be president someday but never will be, Lyndon LaRouche. Two longtime government informants said they were asked in 1984, this is 4 years ago, by both the FBI and the CIA if they would be willing to penetrate and get information about Lyndon LaRouche and what he's doing in Virginia, Loudoun County. Howard and Tucker, two different people, said in an interview that they were in Austin, and their infiltration, their job was aborted when it got underway because the government agents didn't give the final go-ahead. However, the emergence of Howard and Tucker provide a strange twist in this trial. The Texans, who were key informants several years ago in the highly publicized case of U.S. Customs Service, said for years they were working with government informants involving terrorist organizations. They were once contacted by the family of Andrei Sakharov concerning a plot to help free Soviet dissidents. They're used for jobs all around the world as mercenaries. The FBI and CIA representatives were present in Washington law office where Howard and Tucker claimed that the LaRouche penetration was discussed, that the United States wanted to go against LaRouche, and of course, then they settled a man named Mr. Lewis was part of the Army's elite Delta Force under Oliver North, and he was asked to penetrate Mr. Fred Lewis, the operation of Lyndon LaRouche. The FBI documents revealed in this Boston case take a view that the FBI agents and retired Army Sergeant Major Fred Lewis, Mr. Howard and Tucker, would sell information to any and all U.S. agencies, and they provided information, and they would sell it to others, and they were used for infiltration. They arranged through their contact, F. Keith Atkinson, the director of Democrats for Reagan in 1980 campaign, and were involved with events around that. Howard said he met Atkinson in September 84 on a hunting trip. The two men hit it off. They were working together, and the subject of their involving themselves into domestic affairs has been acknowledged by these people, and their meetings where they discussed LaRouche and these projects did take place. And Lyndon LaRouche claims and has the documents now that retired Air Force Major General Richard Secord, and Oliver North said our man here claims that Lewis has information against LaRouche. So this case is developing into a very interesting story that, as I say, could tangle George Bush with the law office of Fensterwald in on the case, and now the evidence of the infiltration in the United States of the FBI and the CIA into these matters. Now, those of you who live outside of the San Francisco area weren't privy to a one-hour television program on the scandal at the Presidio, the molestation case. They gave a summary of it last night. I've had a lot of that on the air with you. The one point that was really interesting I want to share, because the time is running out here, is that there was a fire at the Presidio and records were destroyed of the people of Gary Humbright, the man who ran the Presidio Nursery School, or these fires would conceal it, burning down the records when Humbright had days off, and they could be synchronized with the days that Michael Aquino flew to San Francisco from Washington, D.C., where he was high-level military intelligence, and flying out to San Francisco, which he did. All those papers were destroyed in a fire. That was new information. I can share more with you about the program, but I think I've had pretty much on the air and on the tapes about the Presidio molestation case. It was a very good one-hour summary. I taped it, and someday I'll make a composite of tapes of these Michael Aquino cases and make them available for those people who want it to send a blank tape to me, and I'll make a copy for you. But the time is out now. I couldn't even briefly touch half of the news there has been out this past few weeks. There also was a long article in San Jose Mercury. Pentagon strike team to attack daycare abuse. And another subtitle by Linda Goldston, Defense Department Creates Strike Team to Prevent Sexual Abuse. That was San Jose Mercury, April 17, 1988. Of course, I'll be updating this story for a long, long time, but that is the end of this hour, and we'll continue. This is so much, it's hard to know where to start, but I know the end has to come because the tape runs out. So I'll be back with you next week to try to make some sense out of this insanity. This is Mae Brussel. Thank you for your letters and mail, and remember, send your requests for tapes to me, and I'll pass them on so that you will get your tapes, but I want to become familiar with the names of the people subscribing.